Welcome to Attention Talk Radio, your ADHD information station where we help those with ADHD pay attention to attention. With your host, ADHD and attention coach, Jeff Topper.
Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. I'm your host, attention and ADHD coach, Jeff Copper. Tonight, our topic is ADHD, dopamine, and self-medicating behavior, a conversation. And with us in our virtual studio is Dr. Kenneth Bloom. Very excited. This is the second time we've had him on. If it is half of what the interview was the first time, I can guarantee you guys are going to learn a lot. Real quickly tonight, though, tonight is Wednesday, October the 19th in the year 2016 at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is our third show in this month, which is ADHD Awareness Month. And we always save kind of our best shows and our best topics for this time of the year to kind of highlight. So again, I hope you'll enjoy our conversation tonight. Real quickly, a few comments. One, Dr. Barclay's asked me to promote ADHDfund.com, which is a crowdsourcing website to raise money for small-scale research worldwide. And if you haven't checked it out and you haven't listened to this show, you need to check out the annual CHAD conference. This year is in Costa Mesa, California. It's November the 10th through the 12th. I'm going to be out there myself. I fly out, I think, on the 9th and get back on the 13th. If you haven't been to one of these things, you should go check it out. Moving a little further, we've got a great relationship with CHAD, and tonight's show is actually being brought to you by children and adults with attention and deficit and hyperactivity disorder, and they've got a real quick tip we're going to play for you, and then we're going to get into the meat of the show, so just bear with us.
ADHD challenges continue into adulthood for 35 to 65% of children with ADHD. Finding strengths, building resilience, and learning to self-advocate will improve your child's chances of succeeding in college, vocational school, or the workforce. Learn how to prepare your child for life beyond high school at CHAD's annual conference on ADHD in Costa Mesa, California this November. More information at chad.org, chadd.org.
All right, everybody. And so let's get into the meat of tonight's show. Again, with us tonight in our virtual studio is Dr. Kenneth Bloom. He's made global headlines with his co-discovery of the reward gene or the addiction gene, published by the Journal of American Medical Association in 1990. And subsequent discoveries have led Dr. Bloom to coin the phrase brain reward cascade and reward deficiency syndrome. He's considered by many as the father of psychiatric genetics. And honestly, everybody, you know, I have dyslexia and learning disabilities. A whole bunch of words here I can't pronounce, so I'm not going to kind of try. He's recognized for numerous awards, kind of across the board. And actually, I could probably kind of go on for about 50 million years on this particular topic, but I'm going to kind of hold off for a second because I want to kind of bring some of his bio into the conversation as we kind of get into it. So we'll be back and forth through his bio. With that, Dr. Bloom, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jeff, and to everybody else.
You know, Dr. Bloom, I have to tell you, I'm a coach, and I'm not a mental health professional. I took psychology 101 at Indiana University and got a C. That's the extent of what I know from that side of the world. But as a coach, my world is all about asking questions, insightful questions, questions that people nobody have ever asked before. In the first interview that I did with you, before you got on the show, I keyed it up for you because I was like, I got this question for you. And I said, Dr. Bloom, are we addicted to dopamine? I mean, are we addicted to drugs? Or are we addicted to dopamine? And it was kind of cool because you said, wow, I've never been asked that question before. You're correct. We're actually addicted to dopamine. The drugs that we're addicted to impact dopamine. And that was a really special moment for me to ask you a question that people hadn't asked before, but kind of make that connection. And I think tonight's going to be a really great conversation, an extension of that, because at the end of the day, we like to pay attention to what people are paying attention to. In the sense, people, whether you know it or not, are paying attention to dopamine, the reward neurotransmitter. Does that make sense? Is that we set the table well?
Absolutely, yeah, Jeff. I mean, many years ago when I started out in this career in 1968, we didn't really have a whole handle on how the neurotransmitters in the brain work. We knew about serotonin. We knew dopamine was around. We didn't have any idea about the natural opioids, the endorphins. And glutamate and acetylcholine were around, but people were not really able to actually fish out what was going on and how the brain really worked and how these all new chemical messages work together. And it turns out at the end of the day, after many, many years later, now in 2016, that the culprit or the non-culprit or the thing that we really, really want is to have a normal release of dopamine that actually takes away stress and increases pleasure. So it makes sense that we get addicted to it, or we want it. We have to have it. And that's a very, very good way of starting out, Jeff, because that's really what we're going to be talking about.
So it's the culprit is the normal release of dopamine, and you've coined the phrase reward deficiency syndrome, and you've actually identified a gene in this area. There's people that are kind of across the board. It's not just ADHD, it's substance abuse and everything else. You just want to speak for that just to a minute?
Yeah, well, you see, it turned out that in the 70s and 80s, as people were beginning to understand what was going on in the brain, there were meetings that were separated. First of all, alcohol had a meeting, and opiates had a meeting. Then there was psychostimulant abuse having a meeting. So everything was separated. Obesity was separated.
Uh-huh.
So what we thought was that, you know, we started to see the commonality between an individual who's I hate to say it, like a junkie in the street trying
yep.
to find a fix for heroin, and,
yep.
and an executive alcoholic slushing down 5 martinis for lunch and making a business deal. And,
yep.
and that commonality was really something that was going on in the brain, and there was a common mechanism going on. Now, in 1990, when we actually discovered with Ernie Noble, at UCLA and my lab at the University of Texas, the first genetic association for a particular gene, and that gene was called the dopamine D2 receptor gene, that we found that people that have a variation that actually carries have 30 to 40% less dopamine receptors, and you need the dopamine receptors to react to dopamine, that was a low dopamine function in the brain. And when 1995 rolled along, I started to say to myself, you know, is this a problem, basically a common problem across the board for any addictive behavior? And is that related to low dopamine function? And,
mm-hmm.
and then I came up with the idea. I said, well, what am I going to call this thing? And I started to think about dopamine deficiency. And then I thought about AIDS, autoimmune deficiency
yep.
syndrome, and then I came up with the idea of reward deficiency syndrome. It was that simple.
And you did subsequent research and actually are beginning to identify the genes there, so there's a genetic predisposition to this?
Well, it turns out that the dopamine D2 receptor, or A1 form, we call it, and I said had 30 people that carry it have 30 to 40% less dopamine D2 receptors. Actually, there are many other genes that have been discovered along that particular pathway. And this whole idea of the brain reward cascade is basically how other messengers like serotonin interact with the endorphins in the brain. They affect the substance GABA, which affects the substance called glutamate, and that ends up affecting how much dopamine is being released. So there's many genes that can be affected
okay.
when an individual is born, okay?
Okay.
And that just sets up whether or not you're going to have a normal dopamine function or a abnormal or deficient dopamine function. That's how it works.
All right. So I think we got this kind of teed up because I think the idea here is if you've got an abnormal release of dopamine. And you talked at the beginning, you say it takes stress away, it does some things. The question is, instinctively, does a person seek out and discover things that bring a balance to that, that normal release? So whether it's a substance abuse or listening to music, do they gravitate to that? And are some behaviors actually self-medicating? They're drawn to that because of this. You want to talk to that about that for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really the basis of what we're really talking about. It is well known that alcohol, cocaine, heroin, marijuana, nicotine, glucose, and then some of the behaviors, sex, gambling, okay, internet, smartphones, all of these things actually cause a what we call a preferential release of dopamine right at the place in the brain that gives people reward. So you can imagine if people are actually walking around in their daily life having less dopamine that's normal, they're going to seek out, without even knowing it, seek out anything that's going to make them feel better. And that is going to be related to drugs and alcohol and behaviors that actually cause dopamine release. And that's a form of self-medication.
So, and forgive me here, because I'm going to make some statements here that some of them might be correct and some of them might be incorrect. But to translate it down is, if you have an abnormal release of dopamine, you're kind of seeking that normal level. So you might go do behaviors that get you to that level, not
that's
consciously,
exactly right.
But you're drawn to it. So that would be self-medicating.
Yes.
So one of the shows that I've been –
that would be.
So I'm fascinated, and I want to tee this up. We'll probably need to go to break and come back to it, but I've been trying to – I've been talking – I know Dr. Timothy Willens at Harvard is doing some research right now to use a nicotine patch as an alternative for stimulant medications for ADHD, because from what I understand that we know that nicotine actually helps people focus. And I have a theory that – back in the 60s, people smoked, and if they had ADHD, it actually was a self-medicating behavior that was reinforced by the buzz, if you will, but also the attaboy for increased levels of performance at school and work. So there was kind of like a double whammy. You did it because it was addictive, but at the same time, there was positive reinforcement because you were able to focus. Again, I want to go break for a second, but do you think there's something to that, Dr. Bloom?
Absolutely.
Wow. So – again,
I mean, I know you're going for a break, but there's something that I could refer to in my older career that we did work on nicotine, looking at learning behavior and certain kind of behaviors, and it dovetails into exactly what you say. But the surprise is that it's in a different, it's actually different, a little different. So I'm going to explain that to you.
So I tell you what, let's do this, because one of the things that is kind of funny, because I'm not going to be able to do it, because I was, when I began to listen about this research, I began to wonder, as smoking rates have decreased, has diagnosis of ADHD increased? And I want to come back and talk about what you know the distinctions you're going to make and that question. But before we go, there's a website we want to send people to called www.talkrds.com, and you got a little something on that site that can you tell us, explain to us what that is?
Well, that's a site that explains reward deficiency syndrome, but it also explains the fact that after 50 years we developed a natural supplement that actually balances the dopamine in the brain. We call it synaptamine, and it's a liquid nano that a lot of people had a lot of good effects. Those people that have ADHD, substance abuse, some of the RDS behaviors have been finding it to be very helpful.
And you can learn more about that, and I guess order at talk.
Yeah, you can learn more about it. You can order it. You know, find out all about it.
Yep. It's at talkrds.com. And with that, we'll be right back after these messages.
Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
The average annual cost of attending college starts around $25,000. Students who have ADHD are at high risk of dropping out because they haven't learned the critical skills they need to succeed in school. Protect your investment with an EDGE Foundation coach, specifically trained to help students with ADHD and executive function challenge make the transition from high school to college. Visit edgefoundation.org to learn more or call 206-632-9497 and use promo code EDGE to get your free college success guide.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is timetimer.com.
You deserve the best-trained ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
Managing ADHD is about pausing before you ponder and proceed. This opportunity to practice pausing is being brought to you by digcoaching.com. The Attention Talk Network has over 450 interviews and more than 210 hours of programming, which is overwhelming if you think about it. That's why I've made my list top 10 favorite Attention Talk radio interviews. Download the list at www.digcoaching.com/ATR.
And now back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here with a great conversation with Dr. Kenneth Bloom centered around dopamine. We had a great interview with him a couple years ago, and I think this one's going to probably top it. Before the break, we were talking about dopamine and the normal release and the abnormal release. And if your brain has got an abnormal release, how you would instinctively seek out things that would kind of bring you to equilibrium, kind of like a vacuum, if you will. You know, you go out in the jet and you have a pressure inside and the door, but it's going to come to like a normalcy. And I was kind of talking about smoking and a show that I want to do in the future about this notion and the fact that maybe ADHD diagnosis has risen as people have come off smoking. And Dr. Bloom was going to share with us some of his background on this and actually kind of comment on that hypothesis. So, Dr. Bloom, take it away.
Okay, here it is. First of all, you have to remember this. Nicotine does release dopamine. That is well known, okay? It's
yep.
like Ritalin and can release dopamine. There's differences in the mechanism. However, think about this. Bill Wilson from the AA world actually stopped drinking. Now, you could argue that his drinking was stopped because of his 12-step idea, what he did with Dr. Bob. Or, remember, he kept smoking cigarettes and he died from emphysema. Okay? So that the relationship between nicotine and substance abuse is certainly well known. Now, the fact that you want to consider the fact that as smoking went down, the diagnosis of ADHD went up. That's not far-fetched. That's not a bad assumption. Okay.
Uh-huh.
But to use nicotine as an alternative for another psychoactive drug, I don't particularly think is the smartest thing in the world, okay?
Okay.
I mean, basically, you're just tying it into making them addictive. It's like using methadone for opiates. It's like
okay.
using buprenorphine for opiates. So that's not the smartest thing in the world. And experiments that I did many years ago with animals, we were looking at learning discrimination, and we found out that very low doses of nicotine can increase learning discrimination in animals that can't discriminate. And when we look to see if that's related to whether the effect is a stimulant effect or is it a calming effect, because nicotine has two effects, stimulation and calming. Turned out that the stimulant didn't do it, but the calming effect did it because we showed it with tranquilizers and some other types of anti-anxieties. The idea is that people think better when they're calmer. They smoke to get themselves calm, and then they make a
uh-huh.
telephone call, and they can act better. So it's more of a calming than a stimulant effect, although both of them can cause dopamine release. So that my two cents on that is that don't go down that path because you can just make people more addicted, even though smoking
mm-hmm.
has more alcaloids and cancer-producing agents, but nicotine by itself is not the best thing in the world.
I find that kind of fascinating. So this is great. So let me ask you, Dr. Bloom, Rick Green of Totally ADD, they released a video, I think, earlier in 2016 about medications. And there was a kind of an interesting statement. They were hypothesizing that if you have ADHD and you're not on stimulant medications, you're self-medicating with something by the time you're age 20. What do you think of that comment?
I think it's a very true comment, okay? There's plenty evidence that that if you have ADHD, first of all, the rate of propensity or vulnerability or the risk for substance abuse is much higher in people that have ADHD than people that don't have ADHD. That's for sure, and that's well documented. The question is that, yes, you certainly, if you have ADHD and you got low dopamine function, you certainly want to do something about it. You want to fit in. You want to be happier. You want to be motivated. You want to have better cognition. All these things are related to low dopamine function. So you want less stress. So you're not going to do anything to make yourself feel better. You'll find a way through life. You'll get peers that are smoking cannabis. You'll have alcohol around you. So, you know, going into cocaine, you'll get into these substances. Now, even food, for example, you know, glucose, and then people that have ADHD, that some of them may actually overeat, you know, so all related to a reduction of dopamine. But the problem is, the question is, look, when we have and we give people, you know, or even Striata, but Striata is a little different, but when we give Ritalin, are we inducing these people to become drug addicts later in life? That has always been a question.
Yep.
And the studies that have been done suggest the opposite. They suggest that when you take Ritalin, in a sense, it makes sense, your substance abuse rate goes down, especially if you take it to adulthood. And the reason is that in a sense, it does the same thing as any addictive substance. So you're basically addicted to the Ritalin, okay? And as you get older, that's what can happen. Now, most people would not accept the fact to say that you're taking Ritalin, you're addicted to it. But in reality, mechanistically, there's something to what I say.
Yep.
Now, one of the problems is that, especially in college students, some in high school, is a fairly high rate of diversion. In other words, the people that are using it, college students who are around, they think during the weekdays they're going to use it, they're going to perform better. And by the way, a lot of them, because they don't like some of the effects it has, reduce it during the weekend, okay? Which is, sounds strange, and they probably go ahead and use drugs at that point. So it's very interesting. So diversion is certainly out there in front of people that have been diagnosed with ADHD and have been actually prescribed, stimulants, okay? And then they're in college and other people want to buy it from them. And they become victimized. They become victimized by their peers, actually. And if they don't want to sell it, then people, sort of make fun of them. It's very interesting kind of a social interaction that goes on.
I want to touch base again on this in a little bit, but real quickly, if you want to learn a little bit about the addiction and the abuse of it, we did an interview with Dr. Anthony Rostain, I think about 2 years ago. So if you go Attention Talk Radio, Dr. Rostain, you'll pull up, and it's a fascinating conversation about the abuse and addiction. Also over the summer, and I can't recall the interview because it was anonymous, but we actually had interviewed an individual that was involved with a person in college that was involved in a medical a stimulant diversion. It was very innocent, but got in a lot of trouble. And I think that you might want to listen to that. Again, I want to come back to this, but Dr. Bloom, is if by age 20, if people aren't being treated for ADHD and they're self-medicating themselves in one way, shape, or form, whether it's alcohol or nicotine or maybe excessive exercise, then the question begins to say is, what are the long-term effects of self-medicating as compared to the long-term effects of taking stimulants? And I say that because I think people will say, hey, if I take a drug, like Ritalin or Adderall. What's the long-term effects of that? But also, what are the long-term effects of not taking it and self-medicating with nicotine? It seems to me that the negative effects of not medicating with stimulants and self-medicating with, let's say, cocaine or alcohol or nicotine is far more punitive. You want to talk, comment on that a second?
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. That's another very good question that you're asking. It's a loaded question, okay? My short answer is that if you had something that could balance the dopamine system without causing stimulation, is the way to go. That's what we're promoting in the work that we do now on what we call a pro-dopamine regulator. But this is not a sales pitch. What I'm trying to get to is simply this. There's no doubt that when you take a psychostimulant, okay, and it is well known that if the individual is diagnosed with ADHD at a younger age and before 10 years old, okay, they get onto a psychostimulant, the chances of them seeking out other drugs later in life is lower. Now, if they go after 10 years and they get on it, the chance of them becoming substance abusers beyond the psychostimulant is higher. And we have to understand that it's interesting that nicotine is a very well-known gateway to cocaine.
Yep.
Not so much cocaine for nicotine, but that's another one of the problems that I'm against the nicotine idea. But you have to remember that there's even talk of gateway from marijuana
yep.
to heroin. And what we're living with now is the opiate epidemic. We got 127 people dying every day from heroin opioids. So I'm concerned about the fact that people have ADHD and they have a high proclivity to drugs, including opioids. Okay, and
yep.
To me, it's probably important to get them on to a psychostimulant. Okay. As early as we can so that they don't get into the self-medication. And once they get into self-medication, it's easy to roll into opioid and then have a chance of death. So we have to be, on one hand, realizing what we're talking about. If we're not going to go ahead and go after a natural pro-dopamine regulator that we think we may have, then your option is to go ahead and diagnose ADHD early. Now, I told you that on the side that we're talking about genetics and that we're developing something that's called genetic addiction risk score, which is going to be a test that's going to be able to identify even at birth whether you might have a propensity to all reward deficiency syndrome behaviors, including ADHD. So that's the future. And when pain clinics, when you get a fracture, now you go to the pain clinic and sure enough, they're going to throw you an oxycodone. Well,
yep.
There has been a recent article suggesting that, you know, you could do a test to determine whether or not you might have an opioid risk. That test, by the way, is not very good, but the one that we're developing with a lot of research may allow people
yep.
at an early age to determine whether or not they have ADHD. The earlier we determine whether someone has ADHD, the better off we are.
Yep.
And we're pushing for genetic tests even at birth. So, I mean, this sounds a little bit like
yep.
future science, but it isn't. And that's very, very important because that's what we think is going to suggest potential help and reduce self-medication if we know about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Bloom, we need to run to a break real quick again. Everybody, to learn more about Dr. Bloom and what's the liquid that you were talking about before? I forgot the name of it.
It's called synaptamine.
Synaptamine. To learn more about that, synaptamine. Go to talkrds.com, and with that, we'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Attention Talk Radio. We'll return in a moment. Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is TimeTimer.com.
You can't go off to college with them, but we can. Visit edgefoundation.org to learn more how an EDGE coach can help your student reach their full potential. You can also call 206-632-9497 and use promo code EDGE and get a free college success guide.
Experience the difference with a top-notch ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
The Attention Talk Network has over 450 interviews and more than 210 hours of programming, which is overwhelming if you think about it. That's why I've made my list top 10 favorite Attention Talk radio interviews. Download the list at www.digcoaching.com/ATR.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back with you, everybody. We're here with Dr. Kenneth Bloom. We're talking about dopamine and self-medicating behaviors, and tonight is a conversation. My focus and goal of tonight was to bring your awareness to dopamine and self-medicating behaviors. And Dr. Bloom, I want to, for our listeners, we could get into phenotypes. We could kind of get in off the charts, but I try to simplify things in kind of layman's terms. And I am going to oversimplify this a little bit just so our listening public can kind of understand this a little bit. But at the same time, I want you to correct anything that's really kind of off. But my sense is that those with ADHD, they don't have a normal release of dopamine, and they're going to seek things naturally that are going to give them those normal releases of dopamine. So whether they're conscious about it or not, instinctively, they're going to seek out kind of some of those behaviors. And if you have ADHD and you're not diagnosed, you're not medicated, chances are by the time you're age 20 is you're doing something to do that. Now, after our interview years ago, I began studying this. And literally when people come into me, I have a list of questions that I ask them, like alcohol, drugs, smoking, gambling, shopping, spending, acts of daring, exercise, what's your libido, food issues, music, deadlines, drama, debate, chocoholic, sugar, and picking and scratching. And I ask them that, you know, to try to get an idea of what their dopamine blueprint is. My theory is, and it's probably not correct, but it gives me some insight on where they go. And usually somebody that I'm coaching has one or two of them that are very, very dominant. And I highlight that to them as if to say, you're drawn to these things and they kind of calm you down, which is fascinating because I want to talk about exercise for a second. What's interesting to me is it's not the same for everybody with ADHD. So what do you think of the concept that everybody has their own dopamine blueprint, their map of things that they're drawn to get that normal release of dopamine so that they kind of feel like everybody else does every day? Thoughts?
Well, I think that you said it pretty well. I think there is a blueprint. You have to remember two things. Every single person has some kind of behavioral characteristics. Some are similar, some are different, and that's what makes us unique. But that is always equal to one's genetic makeup and the environment, the impact of the environment. And I think it's very important for people to understand the environment these days, because years ago we used to think that first everything was psychological, then then the genetics came about, and then we start moving to the fact that it's all biological, and 70% is genetic, 30% is psychological. But what happened now over the last 10 years is a field called epigenetics. Now, I don't want to get people turned away from these heavy words, okay? But it's very, very important, and it's important to what you just said, that we have to realize that certainly the environment has an impact onto our genetics. It does not change the DNA, but it changes how the brain translates its expression, meaning that there's certain kind of chemical reactions that the environment can induce onto the genes that can alter whether or not you're going to turn on a gene or turn off a gene. And that's very important. And one of the things that's very interesting is that if you abuse your child, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, two generations later, that abuse actually can change into the fact that now you tend to have a higher sensitivity to even heroin. That also came about even with marijuana. If you give THC,
wow,
not the actual marijuana, two generations later, they still can. They have a high sensitivity for heroin addiction. The basic slogan, Jeff, is that instead of abusing your children, you have to love your pups, because then love changes the expression of genes in the right direction. So we have to now sit back and say to ourselves, what are we doing? What are we doing in this world? The more stress we add on into this world, the higher the chances of these so-called epigenetic effects, which changes the way the DNA code works. And we go backwards, okay? So it's very powerful, okay, that by the time the age of 20 and you have ADHD and you have, and there's nothing that really has been treating you, you're getting a lot of environmental impact onto your reward genes, which may be going in the direction, even if you were not born with the genetic problem. But, of course, if you had ADHD, you're born with certain genetic problems. But the point of the matter is that it's a double whammy effect. The environment as well as your genetic state leads to a reward deficiency that is not easily treated, okay? So we have to understand that, you know, we're feeding the fuel, okay, with the environmental insult that we give our children.
Okay, so that's a great tee up. So I actually didn't even think I was going to talk to you about this before we got an interview. But Dr. Bloom, I was a competitive swimmer in college, swam in the Olympic trials in 1884, was ranked in the world at one point in time, swam under the same guy who coached Mark Spitz, graduated. Several of my teammates were the first ones out of the water at Ironman in Hawaii from like 86 to 94, different people, but all of them I trained with. And so that kind of led me to get into triathlons, which led me to get into master swim coaching of master swimmers, but mostly they were triathletes. It was fascinating to me when I was on deck, because to be a triathlon at that level back in the early 90s is you're either a swimmer, a runner, a biker before you started. Very few people just got into triathlons. And what was fascinating to me was the number of people that were in the pool that, like, it's like they had an eating disorder, or they had beat it. Alcohol problem, a smoking problem, or a prescription drug problem, and they were there. And I kind of felt like it was self-medicating. They were substituting exercise, sometimes at an extreme, as a substitute for whatever it is they were kind of doing before. And there was one woman I actually coached, literally, she was getting cortisone shots for a stress fracture to train. And she was a very well-ranked a triathlete in her age group, but still she could not work out. And I felt like they were just substituting at the time one compulsive behavior for another. But in our conversations, it's almost like they were switching one dopamine thing for another, because after talking to Dr. John Rady in some interviews about exercise, it seems to me that exercise has a profound impact. So can you clear that up for me? Is there something there, or am I misguided?
Oh, no, you're absolutely on the right track. And John Rady, I know well, he was on the right track. First of all, it's known that exercise can affect a substance called BNDF, which can regulate dopamine.
Yep,
and
yep.
Exercise can absolutely cause dopamine release. You know, there's even to go even further than that, even yoga and meditation, it is now known from studies that you actually can increase the release of dopamine by 65%. So
wow.
There's no doubt that that exercise plays a role in these behaviors. Certainly, you're substituting one for the other, and so that if you're a trained athlete, you know, and you're getting getting your dopamine response from what you're doing, and you can't do it, it's like going through a mini withdrawal. Okay, so.
Yep.
You know, you're not getting you're not getting your dopamine being released at the level that you normally get it to. Now, we're not talking about enhancing dopamine to the point where it's unhealthy. We're talking about balancing the dopamine, getting the dopamine out at the right amount so that you feel good. Now, everybody used to talk about the runner's high, and they used to talk about endorphin, as you remember.
Yep, yep.
And what really turned out to be is endorphin controls the release of dopamine. So it's really a dopamine high. So that's changed. But exercise absolutely is involved. Transfer of exercise, especially if you're an athlete, to drugs, to alcohol, to eating, in some cases, is definitely here to stay. That's exactly what we talk about, transfer addictions. It's the same thing if you went in and got an operation for a bariatric operation so that you can eat. Well, almost 30% of these people, later on, they end up start using drugs because they're really sitting with an RDS behavior that could be genetic and could be epigenetic. So that's what you're looking at.
So I want to be careful here because I don't want to – I just found it fascinating to me. I understand Michael Phelps has ADD, and I have to tell you, you know, I used to swim 4 hours a day, and swimming is interesting because you can train to the level of running a marathon every day because orthopedically it doesn't have the pounding, but from your heart, it really does these things. And I used to hear these heartfelt stories about Michael Phelps training on Christmas morning. And after talking to you, I'm like, he just had to go in and get his fix. And I say that kind of tongue in cheek because after the Beijing Olympics and he took some time off, that's when I think he was smoking dope beforehand, but that's when he got caught.
Yeah, smoking dope, you know, he got into trouble, huh?
Because it's almost like, hey, he was getting his fix every day, and now he's on break, and he's not getting it naturally from the exercise. So, again, he's going to seek equilibrium. I'm not so sure it just happened at that point in time. But with the DUIs, it's not to be negative about Michael. It's just say, just biologically and genetically with ADHD, you're going to naturally seek that release of dopamine because it's calming, it's stress-free. And I think that the point of the show is to create awareness around it, particularly if you have it, and begin to manage it and work with it as opposed to just saying no. Because I think that just saying I'm going to stop or I don't need to do this and not acknowledging the power is really I don't think you're going to get anywhere with just trying hard to stop. But if you acknowledge it and work with it, it really makes a lot of sense. So I've been doing a lot of talking about Michael Phelps and stuff like that. So what are your thoughts on what I said?
Well, first of all, I've always felt that as great as Michael Phelps is, we know he's great, that, of course, he has some of the problems, potentially ADHD, reward deficiency syndrome, okay? And when he's not exercising, he's not getting his dopamine fixed, and he's finding other ways to get his dopamine fixed. And that could be through cannabis or alcohol, as we just talked about. So the thing is we have to remember that when we have stress, and I know I said this on the last show, but when we have stress, the dopamine is released from the neuron at rest 100 times to fight off the norepinephrine that we have in terms of stress. So the dopamine is something that you need to fight off stress. And I think a lot of people living in this world under a lot of stress, and whether or not you have a genetic predisposition, and you might not even have ADHD, but of course you're under stress, and you're going to seek out ways to get dopamine released. So not even just ADHD, but just people that don't even have a diagnosis of ADHD are going to, from the environment to stress, for example, are going to start seeking out drugs just as if they would have an ADHD problem.
Yep.
So we have to understand that seeking out dopamine is a way to handle stress. I mean, we know that studies done by David Cummings shown that if you carry the dopamine D2A1 allele, that's the one they have 30-40% less dopamine receptors in the brain. That's the one we associated with all reward behaviors. That's associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, if you have ADHD, along with post-traumatic stress disorder, you might end up with nightmares. Okay.
Wow.
And one of the effects that we published on recently is the pro-dopamine regulator that we're talking about. We showed by using Loretta, we did this work with Bruce Steinberg, Thomas McLaughlin out of the Curry College, and one of the things that we showed by using the pro-dopamine regulator to balance the dopamine, when we look at the brain, we see the fact that 1 hour after using it, we in an ADHD patient, we can actually raise the levels of the bands in the part of the brain called the cingulate gyrus. That's where they make executive decisions.
Yep.
So we're helping that part of the brain by bringing about dopamine regulation. So if you're bringing about dopamine regulation, I could go on and on with all the fMRI studies that we're doing. But if you're bringing about dopamine regulation, you're going to affect the whole idea of stress. You're going to affect the whole idea of a better life in recovery if you're a drug abuser, and a better life potentially as an ADHD person. So that's very very important. And Michael Phelps was a good example of exactly what we're talking about, self-medication.
All right. So I had hypothesized this a long time ago, and I talked to a couple different experts, Dr. Barkley. You and I kind of talked about it, and I forget, I think it was maybe Dr. Rady, because one of my hypotheses is that deadlines is a self-regulating behavior, and everybody said, you know, there's kind of something to that, but nobody would say, yeah, it is. So I'm kind of curious. Can you talk to me about that a little bit? Because those with ADHD, they struggle, and the night before, like a test or a project, they jump into gear and they're able to get that done. And to me, I had hypothesized that stress or whatever, it releases dopamine. It's like taking a stimulant and you can kind of focus, but I don't think that's the case. So can you talk about that for a second?
Well, I think that, Jeff, that's an hypothesis that certainly has the basis of certainly more research. The idea of procrastination, the idea of amotivational, okay, syndrome,
yep,
all of that, whereby you don't do your project until you absolutely have to in the last moment. Certainly, dopamine is very involved in cognition. It's very involved in working memory. It's very involved in long-term memory. It's very involved in motivation. So that your procrastination, if you're not treated, may have to do with, again, dopamine deficiency, okay? So when you get towards the time that you have to do it, you're getting anxious, you're getting stressed, okay? Your dopamine is flying out of the neuron like crazy, okay? And all of a sudden, bang, you got focus, okay? You sit down and there you do a fantastic job. Because you're really at the heightened level of dopamine function at that time. So you're definitely linked to the fact that, again, the procrastination, the lack of motivation to do something, the non-focus is due to the fact that you're sitting with less dopamine activity. And I have to make sure that we understand that it's not just release. Remember, it has to do with all kinds of synthesis of dopamine and receptors and all that. I understand. But I want to make sure that people don't just walk away and say release. But the point is that procrastination and that amotivation, that could definitely lead to stress when you get to the deadline. And now the dopamine is actually being released tremendously to fight that stress. And before you know it, you got great focus and you do a job.
Excellent. And so I want to kind of wrap this up because we're going to have a sequel to this, Dr. Bloom, because you brought up all kinds of other things I want to interview on. But really quick, we've talked about release and receptors in dopamine. And my understanding is dopamine, more or less, is sprayed. It's a neurotransmitter that's sprayed into the synaptic gap that allows, like, electrical charge, if you will, to jump from one neuron to the next. And then after it's sprayed, it's sucked back in. So there's the release of dopamine, and then there's the receptors that kind of suck it back in. And different drugs can impact the release of dopamine and the ability to intake it on the other side. So it's not a chemical imbalance. It's a mechanism in terms of spraying and sucking back in. Is that accurate? Like, well,
oh,
it's simple. It's simplified.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Okay, let me say this. First of all, you know that Ritalin not only does it cause the release of dopamine, it blocks the mechanism by which the dopamine goes back into the pre-neuron. Okay, that's called the dopamine transporter system. Okay.
Okay.
Well, work done by many people, including my Korean friends, Dr. Chow and Kim and those people out in Korea, show time and time again that work on ADHD people and the dopamine transporter system is absolutely linked together. So that you may have, for example, too much a gene that causes too much of the dopamine to be pushed into the preneuron. Now you got a low dopamine. And ADHD,
yep.
That's one of the mechanisms. So what you have to do is find ways in which to enhance the dopamine transporter so that it could keep the dopamine in the synapse so it could work. And that's just one particular important mechanism that we know for sure that you have to work on. Now, if you use Ritalin, it definitely has an effect to inhibit that. And I wrote a song, by the way, Jeff, that's been produced by some good, cool cats in Austin. And one of the parts of the song says, oh my dopamine, please come back to me. When you're near, it takes away the fear. Okay. So that's what it's all about. Okay. It's all about the dopamine transport system. It's very important. That's only one mechanism. There's other mechanisms where there's an enzyme that can eat up the dopamine called catechol-methyltransferase, and that also has to be controlled. So, and by doing genetic testing, we're going to be able to see, look into the brain, and it's like a mirror. It's going to tell us what genes need to be targeted, and that's the future. That's the future. That's what we're trying to do with the pro-dopamine regulation.
Sure I'm going to misrepresent this, but just for public's perspective, my sense, Dr. Bloom, is getting the right medications for ADHD is a little bit of an art because it's a little bit of a trial and error process. But let's just oversimplify. Let's say there's the release of dopamine and the sucking back in side. Some drugs will impact one side or the other side, and depending on the particulars of you, might actually be able to understand which one we need to do to dial it in. And this genetic stuff hypothetically might actually release the recipe of some of those things. Again, I don't have to be right here. I'm just saying metaphorically, we're shooting it at behaviors right now, and we don't really have a test to do that. But the genes and the studies that you guys are doing is actually going to help us dial in. If we can actually kind of crack that code, we can actually A, maybe have a test for it, and B, run some tests and know how we need to treat it, because the brain is infinitely complex, and that makes it very difficult to get the stuff right. So I'm kind of way oversimplified that, but just for simplicity perspective, is there something to what I said?
What you say is 100% correct. I mean, look, that's what all our new scientist friends are looking at, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, the PET scanning, from the Avoca, from the NIDA, all of that is all working towards understanding what ADHD is all about. And the genetics, although it's complex, there's a certain amount of knowledge that could be understood of why we have such risk for all of these reward behaviors through the complexity even of the genetics. And then the environment on top of it, the epigenetics. So once we are able to continue to break the code and break the problem and see and have a mirror to the brain and see what's going on in an individual and looking at these variations in the genes and being able to identify them in an individual, we're going to get to what we call precision medicine. And we're
yes.
going to be looking at the genes, and we're going to be making medicine to fit these and target these genetic variations. And hopefully learn to love our pups, and that will cut the epigenetic
yep.
Impact down. And we may end up with a better way of treating ADHD. The most important thing about it is to make sure that people understand in the world that there is such a thing as ADHD, Tourette's, autism, Asperger's, all of that. And we,
yep.
That's the goal. And the fact that you're doing this talk radio on ADHD. You're doing, like I say in my Jewish way, you're doing what we call a mitzvah. You're doing something very, very important. And keep doing it.
Well, hey, I appreciate it. And we're running a little bit out of time. So, Dr. Bloom, I want to personally thank you for coming on. It is ADHD Awareness Month. This is our third show. It's been spectacular. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and having a conversation. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Everybody, to learn more about Dr. Bloom and some products he got, go to talkrds.com. And we hope you've enjoyed this edition of Attention Talk Radio. Remember, if you haven't done so, check out the CHADD conference at chadd.org. And we hope you catch us next week for another great edition of Attention Talk Radio. Take care.